Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 170 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Now this week we're talking about the Goodwood Festival of Speed. We're recording this on the Monday after the 2023 Goodwood Festival of Speed, which was also the 30th anniversary. So we talk about the origins of the event, the very first one, which Andrew was at, how it's evolved over the years, and then we get stuck into this year's running as well, which was a really good, really busy one. First of all, though, please remember to rate and review the podcast. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button on whichever app you use. It means you never miss an episode, but it actually helps us enormously as well. So please just do that and enjoy the episode. Anyone who had half an eye on your social media feeds or the Intercooler social media feeds this weekend, Andrew, will know that you've had a memorable Goodwood Festival of Speed. We'll talk about it in some detail, but we could talk about the Festival of Speed more broadly because this was the 30th anniversary running of it, which seems like a good time to just sort of reflect and look back, not least because you were at the very first one in, well, I guess 1993. And presumably back then it was just a little garden party, wasn't it?
Well, it was certainly what it was meant to be. Mm. It was one day.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I've still got the program here, which is like a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
There was a display outside the front of the house, but it was an Aston Martin DB7 in a case.
Yeah.
And I think for many people, it was the first time they'd seen the DB7. And we all just sort of wandered around, like, just going, wow. Mm. And just thinking, this company that we've worried about for so long, it would appear to have a future after all. So that was that. They have this massive party now, don't they, on the Saturday night with hundreds of people. Well, then I think we just queued up in the sort of canteen or a cafe or something and got some sandwiches or maybe a plate of chips or something. But I do remember seeing Ken Tyrrell and Ron Dennis sitting on the steps of Goodwood House having their meal and thinking, this is quite cool. And yeah, from there on, it just evolved and evolved and evolved into the absolute monster event it is today. I actually drove at that event. Honda somehow found, I don't know, a dozen NSXs from somewhere. And we were all issued with blue boiler suits for some reason. I can't remember. The only other person I can remember who was driving them was Clarkson was in the run. And it was our first look at the hill. And the hill hasn't changed at all. It's exactly the same now as it was then, albeit with rather more hay bales. And I can remember going up and thinking, this is tricky.
Mm.
This is tricky. And I think that is the enduring thing about the Goodwood Festival of Speed, because everybody goes there and they see all these amazing cars and these incredible stands and everything else. But as a driver, and I think that what people sometimes estimate, often to their considerable peril, is just how difficult it is if you're trying to go fast, to get a car up it, it's a really, really difficult bit of road. It's very narrow. It's got a big crown on it. It's got crests. It's got high speed changes direction. There's obviously Molcombe, you know, the corner of, you know, which gets everybody.
Yeah.
It's a really, really difficult bit. And, you know, I was talking to, I've been talking to loads of people over the weekend, but really, really, you know, household name drivers, Formula One drivers, sports car drivers, you know, about what you do when you go there. And they all say the same thing. They say you make a lot of noise going off the hill, going off the line, and then the rest of the time, you're just looking after the car and making sure that nothing goes wrong. You're not trying to go that fast because, you know, as has been said so many times by so many people, the only run you do that anyone will ever remember is the one that ends up in the bales. And you just don't want to be that person.
And probably the temptation is to think that the spectators are judging you if you drive cautiously. I don't think anyone's doing that. You know, no one's thinking, God, that was a bit tame, wasn't it? They probably just think, well, it's clearly a tricky road. It's potentially a tricky car, cold tyres. It's expected.
I think it's also one of the, I don't really want to say sort of skills because it sounds like I'm sort of blowing my own trumpet, but I think that there is a knack. I think there is a way of getting a car up the hill in a way that probably doesn't look spectacular, but it looks to you, but the car is being demonstrated. You're not just crawling along. People can hear it. They can see it. It looks That's like right. it's moving fast. While at the same time, you are taking no risks at all. You know, no one cares when you get on the brakes of Molcombe. No one's watching your brake lights and thinking, oh, that's a bit of shit.
No.
You know, they're not doing that. And so, you know, and I think the secret to it is to find that balance where you're going fast enough that people just, I am not remotely well known enough to be one of these guys who can go up at 20 miles an hour and everybody loves it because, you know, I'm one of the most famous racing drivers in the world. I'm not, I'm just another bloke in another car. So you're trying to demonstrate the car and finding the balance between making the car look like it's being driven in the way that it was designed to be driven, but without taking the smallest, slightest risk with it is, yeah, I don't think it's easy. And I think that, you know, I've been lucky enough to do it a few times. So I kind of instinctively, I hope, feel that I know how to do it, but it's, yeah, I mean, you only have to look at how many people get it wrong, particularly by going a bit too fast, to know that it's just not, it's not the easiest course in the world to negotiate. And when it goes wrong, it tends to go quite badly wrong, and very, very publicly.
Yes. Well, Malcolm's the one, isn't it? That left-hander that takes you onto the stretch up the hill. And it is a tricky corner because you approach it very, very fast. You go under the bridge and there's a gentle brow. And if you wait until you've come over the brow and you spot the corner, you've crashed.
You have crashed. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to be braking before you can see the corner. And plenty of good drivers have gone off there just because it is so deceptive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's bumpy there. There's a big crown on the road. You're approaching it blind. You're not completely straight. It's kind of like a perfect storm of an approach to a corner. But it's fine as long as you know that it's there. And, you know, and those who go off there can't say, oh, I didn't know. You know, they do put lots of markers out there. You know, you can't drive along there and just suddenly come across the corner and have any right to be surprised by the fact. They don't exactly, you know, hide its existence from you. Yeah, but anyway, so I mean, there were a lot of cars went off there. The Hyundai prototype.
Yeah.
There's somebody telling me it broke the record for the number of bales it went through.
That's not a record you want, is it? But it did. It went off so hard.
I mean, the footage is just unbelievable. I mean, there's a bit of the footage. You freeze frame it, all you can see is straw. The entire picture is just full of exploding straw.
Those bales weigh hundreds of kilograms each, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, and it got, I think it got through four or five rows of them.
Oh.
It's so easy, isn't it, to sort of engage in a bit of schadenfreude and make capital about somebody else's bad luck. I don't know what happened in that particular one. I mean, it looked like he didn't even turn in. And there are some people saying that is indicative of some kind of problem with the car. I suspect it's not.
No, I don't think so.
I suspect it's just, I don't know whether it was a new driver. I mean, it is often the case that the people who go off there are hotshot drivers who haven't been to Goodwood before. So they're going fast and they feel the need to show that they can go fast speed. But they haven't. I wonder if, you know, when we go to the revival and we race there, or the members meeting, you know, you're not going anywhere without getting a driver's briefing. Mm. Now, you don't get that at the Festival of Speed. Mm. They issue you with briefing notes, final instructions, which racing drivers being racing drivers probably don't get read in the fine detail. They should probably be absorbed in. They tend to just sort of go, you know, in the bag with everything else. And I just wonder whether some kind of way, whether it's something that gets written and sent out, which you have to tick and return to show that you acknowledge it, just because, I mean, Malcolm, it's such a sort of bogey corner. And I think that if you found a way of either by in person, you know, when everybody signed on or whatever, just saying to everybody, just watch out.
Mm.
Because I mean, certainly more accidents happen at Malcolm than every other corner on the course put together.
Yeah.
Massively.
Even if you just made it a bit mysterious, just said, if you don't know about Malcolm, ask someone or you will crash. If you just left that in everyone's minds, they would go, hang on, what do they mean by that?
That would save a lot of, you know, red faces and bent metal. But it would also save an awful lot of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, runs at the end of the day being cancelled and spectators having to watch not much happening on the hill. So I don't know. I just wonder whether that might not be a sort of sensible, pragmatic, practical thing to do to ensure it doesn't happen quite so often, which it does.
Yes, you'd think so, wouldn't you? So Malcolm hasn't changed over the years. The hill hasn't changed over the years. I think I first went as a punter when I was 16, 17, something like that. So not quite, well, maybe 20-ish years ago. went with my dad. And I remember walking around, particularly the paddock area, where lots of the cars are kept during the day, with my camcorder just shooting everything, sort of doing a little running commentary. But also, I remember standing by the hill and watching cars and hearing cars being driven in a way I had never seen before. I potentially hadn't been to a racetrack for a race meeting before then. And just the noise, the tyre smoke, the speed. I do remember being totally blown away by it all. It was just so exciting. And, of course, even since then, Goodwood has changed a lot. It's become the UK's sort of de facto main motor show, hasn't it?
It is the British motor show, yeah.
Yeah, and several manufacturers turn up with these enormous stands. I mean, the Jaguar Land Rover one was like an exhibition hall on its own. Just staggering.
Yeah, the Lotus stand, you know, Little Lotus, which obviously isn't that little anymore. Again, you know, a massive, massive presence.
And then there's all sorts going on, isn't there? There's the rally stage at the top, which has been there for a little while now.
Yeah.
There's all sorts going on apart from the stuff running up the hill. It's become a mammoth event, a titan. Maybe some might think it's lost some of its charm from those early years, but I suppose it just demonstrates how brilliantly they run this event and also how much enthusiasm there still is for these machines in this country.
I don't think it has really lost its charm. I think one of the things that I was, you know, most taken by back in 1993 was that you could how close you could get to everything. You know, you could walk up to Formula One cars, Le Mans winning cars, you know, the greatest racing cars, competition cars, you know, that there have ever been. Mm. And you still can.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And there are there is a driver's club where, you know, drivers hang out, but you can often just find yourself rubbing shoulders with your heroes. And, you know, it's not like, you know, modern Formula One, which is basically a gated community where everything is kept away from the paying punter. And I love that about it. I mean, clearly it is a very, very commercial event now. You know, people go there to, you know, to show their wares and to sell their stuff, and that's absolutely fine. But I think ultimately it's still a place where real enthusiasts, if I talk to the people who came up and, you know, chatted to me about stuff, they're just diehard car lovers. And what they know is that they go to the Festival of Speed and they're somewhere, probably quite a lot of places, there is something that whatever their interest is, whether it's bikes, really old cars, really new cars, you know, drift cars, formula cars, rally cars, anything,
it's there. And it's so inclusive, isn't it? You know, no one is left out. You know, if you're interested in any kind of two or four wheel personal transport, then the Festival of Speed is the place to be.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was wandering around. I was there on the Thursday and Friday. The Thursday was lovely and sunny. The Friday was a bit grim, really raining at points. And wandering around, I realised what the star of the show was. And you'll agree with me on this, I'm absolutely sure. The Festival of Speed is not about the racing drivers who get to drive cars, show off on the hill. It's not about the owners of these cars who get to display their expensive metal. It's not about journalists like us who get special treatment. It's not about the manufacturers trying to publicise their cars. It is all about the couple of 100,000 enthusiasts who turn up each year, having spent at least 54 quid on a ticket, and then loads more just to actually get there and spend the day there, having the most wonderful time looking at static cars, watching cars being driven up the hill, seeing people and maybe meeting people that they admire, and generally having a great time being a car enthusiast. The Festival of Speed is all about them. And I was struck by that as I walked around, and you hear little snippets of conversations. And the people who go there love cars, and they are in the best way, and they are car geeks in the best way. They love the finer details about cars and racing. It's not a sort of casual crowd. They love it. And it's actually moving and inspiring just to wander around and watch all this going on. I loved it.
You're absolutely right. And you talk to people who go, who'll come to you and they'll tell you, I never thought I'd see one of those cars, whatever it is, let alone see it, you know, moving, let alone be being driven by XYZ, who would have raced it in period. And, you know, you hear those stories all the time, and that's why people go. It's terrific.
Mind you, if there is an individual who is the star of the show, maybe it's Richard Atwood, who was driving the Porsche 917.
Have you seen the footage?
Yes. How old is he now?
83.
83!
So Richard Atwood, the man who won Porsche's first Le Mans with Hans Herrmann in the wet in 1970. He's 83 years old. And there are a couple of 917s that look like the car that won it. There's only one that won it, and that was the car that he was in. He was in the real deal. And he's going off the line, age 83, giving it absolute death, sideways this way, sideways that way. And you just think, you know, frankly, I'll be happy still to be breathing at 83. And he's just a dude. He is so cool. I completely agree. You know, I know that Vettel was there, and I think he put on a good show, you know, spinning Red 5 and that sort of thing. But if there's one thing that put the biggest smile on my face, it was watching Richard drive that 917.
It was fantastic, yeah. Fair play to him, all credit to him. So, I mean, you were there all weekend for the full 4 days.
Yeah.
Well, 3 days, I suppose. We'll
3 days, yeah.
And you were a guest of Porsche, so you were involved in all the celebrations they had going on. You drove a few interesting cars. I was there for 2 days, and on the first day, the Thursday, I was just wandering around, really. But there were several cars that I wanted to have a look at, like the Singer DLS Turbo, which is that wild thing inspired by the Porsche IMSA car from the 70s, the 9345, I think it's called, with outrageous arches, crazy rear wing. It's an extraordinary looking thing. It's not the Singer I would want, but I understand why they've done it. Do you know, I was at a different event earlier in the week, Supercar Drivers Secret Meet, where they've got every hypercar you can imagine all lined up. And there's a Singer DLS in the middle of them. And I think the Singer DLS, the standard DLS, is a gorgeous car. But in that company, it looks very, very subtle. And so I can well understand that there are plenty of people out there with the means who would like a Singer that stands out in that kind of company. And I guess that's what the DLS Turbo is.
It certainly stands out. For me, I think maybe it was a bit too, I don't know. The problem is, if you're going to do that kind of homage, and I think the DLS, the one you were talking about, is absolutely gorgeous. But I think if you're going to do that kind of homage to an absolute classic from the past, it's just got to be done so well. And, you know, I like the fact that it's striking. I like the fact that it makes a real, real statement. Maybe it doesn't matter that it's not pretty. Mm. Maybe I'm just getting at this. Maybe it's just designed to make a visual impact. I think that's a gorgeous car. I think that's a brutal looking car. Maybe that's the point.
And it was followed all weekend up the hill and around the sort of paddock and so on by what they call the classic turbo study. So, now their entry-level car, which is going to be built in greater numbers, but of just a very pretty, quite subtle, almost delicate thing. And you got the contrast there, the two sort of bookends of Singer. And I suppose, you know, as long as they're building the subtler, prettier stuff, why can't they do a few of those more outlandish
Absolutely.
Ones?
Yeah, I think they can sell them. Good luck to them.
I also went to see the Caterham Project 5. We're calling it Project 5, not Project V, aren't we? We think it's a Roman
name. No. Oh, I got a right meaning for that.
Oh, really? So it is V?
Yeah. It's V. It's V for volts.
Volts, okay.
Volts. Yeah, I wrote about it being Project 5. It isn't.
Volts, okay.
So there you go. So you heard it first here. It's Project V.
Well, there we go.
Because it's electric.
Clarify. Okay. Yeah. And it was in Caterham's stand in a little sort of, almost a glass box, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and it's surrounded by people, so it's hard to step back and get a sort of overall view of the thing. But from what I could tell, it really does look, actually maybe prettier than it does in the pictures. You get the sense of its proportions, the shape of the rear arches in particular. I thought it looked fantastic. And I just hope that, A, that car does go into production, and B, it's not watered down too much when that happens.
I was lucky enough to have a kind of walk around with Anthony Gianarelli, who designed it. I think he has done an outstanding job. I think it is absolutely beautiful.
Mm.
And I said to him, how different is it going to be? And he said, basically, that's the car.
Wow.
You know, he said, you will scarcely notice any difference at all.
Brilliant.
Which is great. I still think there's a hell of a job to be done with it.
Mm.
I really do. And I hope to goodness that they can do it. But I've seen so many British sports car manufacturers try to reinvent themselves and come a cropper. Because they know that if they can charge, you know, big money for this, and I think they're looking at this thing starting at like 80 grand.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it is so different. I think in most people's heads, you know, a Caterham is a car that costs up to and around about 40 grand and weighs 500 to 600 kilos. Well, for this car, you've got to double it.
Mm.
You know, it's 80 grand and it weighs 1,200 kilos. And it's an EV. And it is such a mental leap. Mm. I mean, okay, let me put it another way. If they put a Lotus badge on it, I think that it would do unbelievably well.
Yeah.
But I am mindful of the fact that, okay, and this is by no means a direct parallel. Nevertheless, there was a period when Caterham did try to do another car, a more upmarket car, a more civilised car. They called it the 21.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And you know, I was saying this to them, and I said, the job you guys have got to do, and it's not as if they don't already know this, is that, you know, there's a hell of a marketing job to be done, because it would be awful if a company that is being that brave and which has designed a car that is that beautiful cannot make it work for them, because it's just not what people expect from a Caterham. And they're not prepared to spend 80 grand on something which at the back of some people's mind is still a kit car company. We know it's so much more than that. But, you know, and I think that is a very real concern. I wish them all the best with it. I really do, because I think it is fantastically brave. I think it is brilliantly executed. And I love it when the good guys win. Mm. But that doesn't mean that they always do. So I'm going to keep everything crossed, because, you know, it's the first EV sports car, really, since the Tesla Roadster 15 years ago, which was the first EV, effectively. No one's gone anywhere near that for 15 years. And Caterham has finally stuck its head up above the parapet. But, you know, we know that Lotus is going to do something not unlike that. And whatever it was 27, 28 years ago, it was the Elise that killed the Caterham 21. And I would just hate for Caterham to come a cropper with this, because it was a great car, but, you know, we all know, don't we, that just because, you know, look at the Alpine A110, just because you make an amazing car doesn't mean you can sell it.
No. No, and actually it's not immediately obvious that there is any kind of a market for EV sports cars. You know, there isn't one currently, because there's no such car, but we can't say for certain, or with any real confidence at all, that buyers of recreational cars like this are comfortable with an electric powertrain. So there's a job to be done there, as you say, and it's, you know, not just for Caterham, but Lotus, Alpine, Porsche, and all the others.
Yeah,
we're going to find out fairly soon, I suppose.
Yeah, but the time will come where if you want a sports car, it's going to have to be electric. So
it's
so much of this stuff has got actually very little to do with the product. It's to do with who's making it and how that is perceived and when it is introduced.
Mm.
And you know, there will be some manufacturer who's just sort of sitting back and thinking, well, this is all very interesting, but you know what? We're just going to wait and see. We're going to learn from their mistakes. And when the time is right, we'll come to market with a car based on all that knowledge, all that learning, none of it our knowledge or our learning, but we'll just sit there, we'll watch what other people do, and then we will turn up with something that is right. And, you know, that might happen. I really hope it doesn't. I can say, because, you know, I think a lot of people know that I am a Caterham man through and through, always have been, and I wish them all the best with it.
What I will say about an electric sports car is that the packaging is quite interesting, isn't it? Because there's no conventional combustion engine powertrain. So this Caterham Project V, it looks sort of roughly Alpine A110 shape and size, but you can have a 2+2 or a 2+1, which is unusual. Mm. One seat in the middle at the back. You certainly can't do that with a car that size and a conventional powertrain. So that is quite interesting. But yes, I suppose we'll see when that car and others like it begin to come through. Now, there was another debutant that I wanted to have a look at. That's the Aston Martin Valor. But it wasn't on Aston Stand. It was in a different area.
I was going to say, I went over to Aston Stand to find it.
Yeah,
it wasn't there, so I wandered off. I never saw it.
I had to ask Twitter where it was, and it was in the Gurney enclosure, so opposite the Cartier lawn. But I went over a couple of times, but I never had the right pass. I must remember to be more important, because I didn't get on the stand. I didn't get to see the bloody thing. So it's weird to have this car that they're trying to make a load of noise about, and you can't actually go up and see it unless you are one of the privileged few. It was odd. So I don't know. I've still not seen the Aston Martin Valor. Maybe I will at some point.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So we'll come on to your Porsche exploits, because there's a lot to discuss. But on the Friday, I was with Land Rover riding up the hill in the new Range Rover Sport SV. This is the replacement for the Range Rover Sport SVR. They've dropped the R, not because this is a more sort of comfort-minded car or a less sporting car. In fact, it is, they call it, the sportiest and most dynamic Land Rover ever built for the road.
Is that not a contradiction in terms?
Which one?
Sporty, dynamic Land Rover.
I know.
Or am I still stuck in the past? Am I still thinking about the Series 3 I got in the shed?
Maybe you are, but the thing is, the Range Rover Sport SVR sold so well. People love them. The buyers just lap them up. And so I suppose Land Rover are going to do it.
So why have they dropped the R?
Because it was confusing people. The SVR was built by SVO. Other SVO cars are just SVs. And so people didn't really know quite what SVR meant. And what they say is that whenever they apply the SV badge to a model, it amplifies the character of that car. So there's a Range Rover SV, and SV amplifies the comfort and luxury of that vehicle. And there's a Range Rover Sport SV, and SV amplifies the sportiness of... That's bollocks, isn't it?
Okay, I didn't realise that at all. I just thought SV was more of everything, regardless of what it was applied to.
So it's a new thing, I think.
I don't understand the confusion about the letter R. Everybody knows what R means.
Mm.
You know, it's race, isn't it? That's what people mean. If you've got a Cayman S and your mate's got a Cayman R...
Mm.
His came as faster than yours, isn't it?
That's clear. And actually, the fact that I had to ask why they dropped the R and whether that meant this was a less sporting car suggests that there was more confusion.
What my assumption would be.
Yeah.
Oh, it's an SV. It's only an SV. It's not an SVR. It's like a Mercedes. Where's the R coming? Yeah. I won't get one of these because I'm going to wait for the R.
I don't know.
I'm sure their marketing department have got very sound reasons for that, but. And I'm not in the market for it, and I'm probably not as close to it as I should be. But to me, I have, through that name change, through that strategy change, I have misunderstood what that car is.
I had. Until I saw it parked up and noticed that it had carbon fibre wheels.
Wow.
So this is the Range Rover Sport SV first edition, or edition one? First edition, I think. Limited to 500 and something cars, all sold out. In no time at all, 170,000 pounds. So not all
170,000 pounds.
yeah.
For a Range Rover Sport.
Yeah. So not all of them. Rums. Not all Range Rover Sport SVs will have the carbon wheels and the carbon ceramic brakes, but these first edition cars do, and they have that not really to save weight because it's clearly always going to be a massively heavy car, but to save unsprung mass, and that is quite important. And those wheels. Yeah. And brakes do save in total 75 kilograms of unsprung mass. That's more than me.
Yeah, it's not more than me.
And that is significant. That really does make a difference, particularly to ride and suspension tuning. So it does make a difference. Now the wheels look quite well protected by the tyres, but even so, you're going to hate to curb one of those things because goodness knows what they cost to replace.
I was talking to Andy Preuninger. I'm sure everybody knows who he is. He's the man who's developed the Porsche's GT cars for the last 20-something years. And I said, why don't you do? You know, you guys are absolutely addicted to lightweighting. Why can't you get a carbon wheel on any of your cars? And he was talking to me about a product I can't discuss at the moment, but it's going to have magnesium wheels. And I said, why do you want magnesium? Magnesium corrodes, and wouldn't carbon be better? And he said, A, they might have corroded in the past, but that there are new alloys, new ways of treating them, and so that's not the issue it was. But also, he said, they're lighter.
Oh.
And he said, why would you have a wheel that was as expensive as a carbon wheel, as difficult or almost impossible to repair if you clout one? And their view is mag is just better. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure if I had a conversation with the people who decided to go with the carbon wheels on the Range Rover Sport, they would come up with a completely different set of justifications. But I just think it's interesting when someone who is clearly as highly regarded as Preuninger, would be in a position to have carbon wheels, and you could see that there might be a huge advantage, chooses not to do it.
Even so, whoever thought there would be a Land Rover with carbon fibre wheels? That really does feel like a moment in time, doesn't it? It's amazing.
Well, the fact is, they're all, you know, all these first edition cars are sold, so you know their success is already proven. So good luck to them.
So the really interesting thing about this car is its new suspension system. Now the higher spec Range Rovers and Range Rover Sports have 48 volt active anti-roll bars. They're clever bits of kit, and they really do make a difference to how a car rides and handles. For this, they've got rid of that. They've junked it. And instead, it has no mechanical connection between the wheels on either axle. Like McLaren, it uses a hydraulic circuit to manage roll control, but it's got a second hydraulic circuit to manage pitch and dive, so forward and backwards. So it's got these two circuits, and what it means is that, like a McLaren, you get this amazing ride quality and body control because you don't have whacking great anti-roll bars ruining the ride. But it's not just roll control, it's forward and backwards. So I was driven up the hill in this thing. When the driver accelerated really hard, and goodness me, this thing gets off the line, it just squats down a little bit and then pings off the line. And the previous car, which didn't have any of these systems, that thing would sit down so low at the back with its nose in the sky. And then when you stand on the brakes, it would go right up on its front wheels. And the effect of that is that it feels kind of wayward, the old car. This new one, it's actually freakish. It feels super well controlled without just being on massively stiff suspension, so it still rides. And actually, it felt like a very well-sorted performance saloon car in the way that those body movements were so minimal. So it's a very, very interesting thing. I can't wait to actually drive it for myself and drive it on a road. But it's a super clever bit of technology that they've developed. And interestingly, this isn't Land Rover that's done this. This is Land Rover Special Vehicle Operations, SVO. This is a team of 11 chassis engineers who have done this. And it is a world first. So they've gone to extraordinary lengths to try and make this thing so much more athletic and agile than the previous one. I don't think I can squeeze a full TI story out of this, but I'll write a short blog post explaining the suspension system in more detail, because it's very, very interesting. And, you know, I credit to them for going to such enormous lengths to try and build the best car.
Are they
going to
roll it out across other things, or do you have to spend 170 grand before you can enjoy it?
As I understand it, the Range Rover Sport SV, the non-first edition cars, will have it. And then I would imagine it would get rolled out across other stuff eventually, but I don't know, we'll see. It's very interesting, though. What else did we have? Did you get to see the Lamborghini Le Mans car?
I did, yeah. I went to the unveil. It looked good. It looked good.
SC63, which makes it sound like an AMG to me, but it's not. But cool looking thing.
Yeah. It does look cool. I think it's great that they are... that they're finally going racing at a decent level. I mean, yeah. I know that Lamborghini has been doing GT3 racing and that sort of thing. And I contend that Lamborghini has, apart from doing some Formula One engines, it's never been a racing brand.
No.
And I think that's actually really held it back over the years. You know, they've never built proper prototypes to race in the World Endurance Championship. They've never done their own Formula One car. And that sort of thing. And I think it's great that, having been very critical of the FIA and the ACO recently about the way they conducted Le Mans this year, I think that in coming up with these new categories and the avalanche of interest from manufacturers, because they are affordable and they also provide companies with means of holding on to their staff and that sort of thing. I think it's great. The car looks fantastic. It looks like a Lamborghini, which I think is very impressive. Who knows whether it'll be quick? But the other thing is, from a manufacturer point of view, there's not much jeopardy, because even if it isn't that quick, well, they'll just balance a performance until it is.
Yeah.
So it'll be competitive. It'll be great to have, and BMW will be there. Acura, I think, might be coming in, as in Honda, Lamborghini. So, you know, if we thought Le Mans this year was full of great brands, next year it's going to be, you're not going to be able to move for them.
No, that's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
So the Saturday was cancelled owing to the weather. I wasn't there on the Saturday. I don't know what the weather was actually like, but given the forecast, for very, very strong wins. And given that there would have been threat to, you know, danger to the people who were there, this has to be the right decision, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly a couple of things. Firstly, I think that people were overwhelmingly supportive. I was out doing something else, because we had suddenly find ourselves quite a lot of time on our hands. I was out on the road driving GT3 RS. First time I've driven it. I think first time anybody might have driven that thing on the road. And I was just parked at the side of the road in a lay-by, taking some photographs. And a Tesla screeched to a halt beside me. And a couple of guys got out, father and son. They'd driven down from North Yorkshire to go to the Festival of Speed. And far from spitting tacks and going, you know, we spent all this money, we booked hotels, we've done this, we've done that, you know, our weekend is ruined. They said, it's not great, but under the circumstances, I don't see what else they could have done. Mm. And the thing that I think you have to appreciate is there are so many temporary structures there. So many things which, if a proper, and it's not about, you know, you look at it and you think, oh, well, the winds were only blowing constant at 35 miles an hour. You get a 60 mile an hour gust, and there were gusts of those sorts of strength blowing around that part of the country at the time. Gets up underneath something and lifts it off. I mean, it could land on anybody or anything. Mm. And to me, it was absolutely clearly the only decision that could be made, because if it had gone wrong, I mean, they might have got away with it, you know, and whooped it up if they did.
Yeah.
But if it didn't, that would be the end of the Festival of Speed. If something had got in the air and, God forbid, come down on someone with, you know, tragic and possibly terminal consequences, no more Festival of Speed.
Yeah.
So they did, you know, and it's the other thing is the Festival of Speed has been happening for 30 years. You know, originally it was a day, then it went to two, then it went to three, then it went to four. So I don't know how many days of the Festival of Speed there have been, but many hundreds. And this is the only time, the only day, that it has had to not be opened. So I don't think that's a bad record. And as I said, I don't think, you know, they could have done anything else.
No, and if you're going to take a chance like that, by if they had chosen to run it despite the forecasts, maybe you do get away with it. Maybe you get away with it 10 times or 20 times, but it only has to go wrong once for the consequences to be disastrous. So,
and you have no control over that, particularly because you've got thousands of concession stands there. And you don't know what everybody else is, all the infrastructure they bring, and you know, you don't know, you can't go around to every single tent and just say, have you got everything properly bolted down? Have you done risk assessments? Do you know what will happen if this is hit by a 60 mile an hour wind? It's literally impossible to do, so you can't take the risk.
Okay, so tell us about your weekend with Porsche.
Well, I'm not going to blather on about it. A, because I'm going to write about some of it on TI, and B, you know, I think I spend more than enough time on this podcast banging on about the stuff that I've driven and what a lucky boy I am. I did drive the Porsche 936 that won Le Mans in 1981, but I'm not going to tell you about that. Sorry, because I'm going to write about that because there's a very specific and interesting story behind that car and how it got on that grid and how it did what it did. The car that I was most happy to be in, so Friday, as you said, the weather wasn't great. In fact, the weather for a lot of Friday was absolutely lousy. And of all the cars that Porsche brought, there was only kind of one which you wanted to be on a day like that, which was the 953, the car that won the Dakar. In 1984. And as luck would have it, I drew it on that day. And it's, you know, it's a 911, and it won the Dakar that year, but it's designated 953. It was the first ever four-wheel drive Porsche. It's basically, it's a 911 on stilts. So 84, so that would be an SC. It's actually got a slightly detuned engine in it because it had to run on the kind of fuel that you get in places like Mauritania and Senegal and that sort of thing. But it's completely open. It's got no silencing at all, so it's ridiculously loud. And you could just go skittering off the line in this thing, and it doesn't really matter whether you're on the tarmac or on the grass. It doesn't seem to bother the car at all. There's very little grip, so you just skidded about the place. And it was just so much fun. It was just such a... And often, you know, sometimes you find yourself on the hill in what is quite a slow car, and it's such a relief.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, because you're just, you know, no one's expecting anything of you, and you're just bimbling along, having a fun, having a bit of a skid, and it's just, you know, whereas if you're in the car I'm going to talk about next, you know, if you're in an absolute monster, I guess it becomes serious fun rather than just fun.
They talk about type one and type two fun, don't they?
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Fun at the time and fun that's fun afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. So the Dakar was fun at the time. Mm. Yeah, but also, it's still such an important car. And, you know, because the Festival of Speed, it's not a motor racing event, so the terms of engagement are different. So, you know, I think I was probably still wearing the seatbelts that René Mettger had on him when he won that event. And the car is completely unchanged. And wow. it was just fantastic just to be in there and to hear it and to drive another car that was part of a very different part of Porsche history. Mm. And then I got in the 917-30.
Blimey. Yep. So this is a 917, but it's the open top car, isn't it?
So this is the car that most people will think of, who know about the 917-30, will think of Mark Donohue racing it in Can-Am in 1973. Blue car, Sunoco, diehard livery, won everything, and basically killed Can-Am because nobody else wanted to compete after that. But
turbocharged, before they could, how big is the turbo? Pretty enormous.
Twin turbocharged, both of them the size of dustbins. 5.4 litre twin turbocharged flat 12, producing 1100 horsepower all day long.
What does it weigh?
800 kilos.
Oh, that is ferocious.
Well, I mean, I was trying to do the maths. It's about, I think, the same power to weight ratio as a modern Formula One car.
Yeah.
But with massively more torque.
Poor.
So it's, you know, this car may be, well, this car, yeah, it's good. The car I drove is about 50 years old. But it's still, well, I'll get to that in a minute. So they made this car, the 917-30, which, you know, famously went off and did everything that it did in Can-Am. But before they could do any of that, they needed a test car. And so the car I drove was a test car, chassis one. And amazingly, they made it, because the car they had before was called the 917-10, which only had, poor thing, 1,000 horsepower.
Yeah,
it was a tricky car to drive. It did win the championship in 1972, but they thought that this thing would be calmed down somewhat, particularly if they're going to give it even more power by having a longer wheelbase. So what they did was, the car that I drove had a variable wheelbase. Wow. They could run it. And I'm not sure how they did it. I guess they did it with the suspension.
Yeah, rather with than different wishbones sort of or something.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than sort of like welding in more tubing between them. Yeah. and they eventually, you know, so they went to places like Paul Ricard, and I think Mark Donohue drove this car, and they settled on quite a big extension to the wheelbase. And so they then parked that car until 1974. I think it did do maybe a race or two in 73. But in Europe, there was a much less well-known series called Interserie, which is basically Can-Am for Europe. And it's exactly the same car. So this went off, and then 1974 did the Interserie series. And it did six races, won five of them.
Hmm.
And then it won another one in 1975. And then that was that. So this was the car that I drove. I think it's Valent. I think it's sponsored by a boiler, a company that made boilers, central heating systems. And it's been restored over a period of time by the Porsche factory. And how can I put this? It is now very, very healthy.
Mm.
Yeah. Every single horsepower it ever had is still there, and maybe a few more. When I asked the brilliant bloke who was helping me with it and looks after the car, and I said to him, come on, how much power? And he went, 1,100 horsepower. Pause. Maybe more.
Yeah, it was definitely more then.
Now, yeah.
Okay.
So
1,100 horsepower plus. 800 kilograms. Yeah. Is there a less ideal place to try and to get to grips with a car like that than Goodwood? You've got tens of thousands of people there, many more watching online, and the social media feeds are going to keep resurfacing anything that looks a bit dramatic.
Goes wrong. Yeah.
It's narrow, it's tight, it's twisty,
potentially
quite slippery after all the rain.
Yeah. And you've got 1 minute.
Yeah. Yes.
And literally, the first time you drive the car ever is when you get down to the start line.
Yeah.
So if there is any footage of me going up the hill, when I go off the line, I have driven the car for about 30 seconds.
Bloody hell.
And you've got to try and understand this thing, not crash this thing. And there are other complexities to it, other than the fact that it's a ridiculously powerful car and a very light body. Mm. For instance, you know, you are on absolutely stone cold tyres.
Yes.
This was on Avon treaded slicks. So, you know, which, you know, they're absolutely massive tyres, but they are stone cold. There is no way you can warm them up.
Mm.
You can, by giving it absolute death off the line, warm up the rear tyres a bit, but that actually just gives you even more understeer when you get to turn one.
Yeah.
The other problem with this car is it has an essentially locked differential. 100% lock up. Which gives you amazing traction on the way out of corners, the price of which paid is that it just doesn't want to turn into corners at all, particularly on cold tyres. So, yeah, so you've got to try and understand all that, and you've got a minute in which to do it, and the price of getting it wrong is unimaginable.
Yeah. Nevertheless, off you go.
Nevertheless, idiot that I am, I kind of think that's something that I wouldn't mind having a crack at. So I think probably the best thing I did, I'd said to them, you know, how do I get this thing off the line? It revs to, okay, I only used 7, but it revs to 8, I think. Mm. So I probably didn't feel all 1,100 and something horsepower. I probably only felt 1,000 of them or something. But they said, give it about 5.5 and don't drop the clutch, just feed it in. It'll be fine. So I thought, okay. So I did that, and the racket this thing is making as you're sitting all the line with 5.5 on it. Mm. I mean, even with earplugs in, balaclava helmet, it is just your entire space between your ears is just full of this sound.
Mm.
And then you're just thinking, I'm really not sure what's going to happen now. I guess we'll find out. And the light goes green, and you take your foot off the clutch. And you know what? It was just beautiful. It just, you know, I got very lucky. Well, the bloke had told him, I got just the right amount of wheel spin, and the thing just went surging forward, and I was just thinking, this is brilliant. I'm just having a great time here. And then I got to turn one, and it just didn't turn.
Oh, God.
It just didn't turn, despite the fact that I kind of was expecting it, because, you know, I knew what I was dealing with, and, you know, I understand the way these things work. Even I just, with all the preparation, just didn't expect it to not turn. And there was a split second when I was sitting there thinking, this might be interesting. Mm-hmm. And I might have to really try and manage this situation. But by that stage, I'm completely off the gas. And there's a lot of engine braking. Yeah, so something else I've failed to mention is the car does 100 miles an hour in first gear.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm still in first.
Wow.
And so you've got an enormous amount of engine braking, and you've got the weight pitched forward. And so then it bites and you turn in and your heart comes out your mouth and you think, oh, well, that's all right. And then, yeah, got through turn two, second gear past the house. I don't know what it would do in second. It would probably do 160 miles an hour or something like that in second gear. It's got 4 gears.
Wow.
And I imagine best part of 203rd and then everything else up to 240 or so in top. So you're second gear past the house and you're you still haven't put your foot anywhere near the floor yet.
Mm.
Anywhere near it. And you are really, really bloody motoring. And then you're just thinking, Malcolm, 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 Malcolm. And you've had this experience of the thing not turning in. So you're thinking, okay, so I'm going to be super conservative with this, which I was. I think I changed back down to first. And, yeah, it was, that was kind of okay. And I thought, well, okay, those are the slow corners done. And I knew that it would be better in the quick corners because the diff wouldn't have such so big an effect. So I let it go a bit more going up the hill towards the flint wall. And that completely blew my mind. And I was thinking, well, this is one of the most intense experiences I've ever had in a car. And then the next bit, so like through the flint wall and the right that's after that, I was just kind of managing it because it's so narrow there. And it's just so difficult. And I was just thinking to myself, all I've got to do is get it out of the last corner and straight. And then I have to find out what this thing will do. And so I got the car straight and there's a short run to the finish line. And I just thought, well, sod it. I'm just going to put my foot all the way down.
And explosion. When it
bit, yeah, I said on Twitter, and I absolutely admit, happily, no one has ever detonated a bomb right behind me, but it's like a shockwave hits you. It's like a force you cannot understand, and you're very aware of it for being behind you for some reason. And you're just... The horizon kind of moves towards you. And briefly, your brain kind of splits. Half your brain is just in panic mode because it has not experienced anything like this at all. And it is such an alien. And it is thinking, you know, this is not something that is sustainable with, you know, continuing to exist because we've never done this before. And look at the environment. Look how narrow this road is. But then there's another bit of your brain which is going, actually, this feels all right. The car's still going completely straight. It's not snaking. You know, you're not having to correct the steering. So stay with it. So I did.
Wow. Bloody hell. And across the line you go.
And across the line you go and just, you know, file that in the one for the grandchildren memory. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And you weren't one of the handful of cars that met a hay bale yesterday. Several went off, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And as I said earlier, you know, you could be smug about it and go, ha ha, you know, pull it. But actually...
It's easily done.
It's just so easy to do.
Yeah.
And there, but for the grace.
Yeah.
Genuinely.
Quite.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Goodwood Festival of Speed. 30 years of it. We love it. It's become a titan event. And, well, we look forward to it every single year, don't we? And bring on 2024. Now, once again, we're not going to do a listener question because that was a busy episode. We'll save this one that I've got. Actually, we're not here next week. We're taking a week off, a summer break. So you'll have to make do without us for 1 week. But we will be back after that, chatting more nonsense about cars and racing and all that good stuff. So tune back in a couple of weeks. And we look forward to talking to you again then.
Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.